personally.
So, but this group started out basically a half a dozen or so of you in a study group, in other words.
Well, we got the faceless call, and we wanted to join the form of political, the Flint branch of the Socialist Party. And we did that pretty early, Serna. No, it wasn't a study group. Dad says, let's form a socialist group, just meaning socialists get together. And then we wrote to the Socialist Call. Now, I can't tell you whether that was a year or 2 years after our reading. The American Guardian we kept taking for quite some time. But I can't tell you when we got the Socialist Call and when we applied to become a branch.
And by this time, you had been doing reading.
Yeah.
So
yes.
On your own and talking to your father-in-law.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you were already pregnant or already had your first child then?
I don't know. Part is so blurry to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember where he was born. He's up in this little apartment upstairs in my parents' building.
He was born at home?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With your midwife grandmother attending?
No, my grandmother was in another town at the time. I don't even remember. The doctor was there. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And my mother came up. And my mother went panicky. My mother and my doctor came up. And my mother went panicky. I got very apprehensive and got all tight and all nervous and everything else. And I said, get that woman out of this room. Get that woman out of this room. At first I tried to say, Mother, go, you know. And she wouldn't. Then I had to get real, real tough with her. And that broke her heart. She had to be taken out, and because I was insisting, I wasn't going to go any further with none of this nonsense. And just the doctor and I were in there. Mother.
Is it usual for a woman still of your background, in terms of class, to have your child at home?
Mm-hmm. Isn't that? In the small little village town. They had a county hospital, and they had a little private woman's hospital, I think, woman's lying in hospital or something like that. And I could have gone to either one of them, but it wasn't common for childbirth. It wasn't, perhaps some women did go, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't too concerned with the whole problem of raising kids or anything else. This was just an accident that happened. I had to go through with the act.
Did
and,
you think about trying to get an abortion?
No, that? I didn't know you could do such a thing. My God, if I had ever known that such a thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to finish up high school so bad, and I couldn't because of this... business. I even went back to school knowing I was pregnant.
After you returned to Flint, you went back to high school to try and finish?
Yeah. He finished. He stayed in school. We were living at home until June. And then it was after June we went to Ypsilanti. And in September, I went back and I stayed for, a half a semester or something like that. And then I couldn't. Then I became pregnant and I couldn't go any further. Yeah. And I had to drop out. And I was so resentful toward nature and everything else. I didn't have any idea that you could get an abortion. Never heard the word.
Hmm.
Never knew about it. I thought that it was just one of those terrible things that women had to go through, you know. Oh, I would have been tickled to death. I would have been up there before the doctor got in his office had I known anything like that.
And even among someone like your father-in-law who was certainly in contact with other radicals, you never would have known about
it. Radicals did not know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And among the radicals themselves, he was an exception because most of them were chauvinists. They felt that the movement had to be run by the men, and it was very wonderful if they had an intelligent woman, you know, who could talk to other women and bring them in. But the other women primarily, by and large, were supposed to provide the social affairs or... make things comfortable for them so they could go out and recruit other people and so on. No, among the radical parties, believe me, there were chauvinists that you wouldn't believe. And it wasn't conscious, I don't believe, but it was just an ingrained, it was a part of the whole social fabric of the time, yep.
Now, I want to try and clarify about bringing in the tuberculosis because it starts playing a role in your life at this point of being in and out of hospitals and having pneumothorax and your cut, but your son was born, and then somewhere in there, in that same time period probably, is when you applied for a charter to be a branch or a local, of the Socialist Party, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, you were a committed socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And had been doing a lot of reading.
Mm-hmm.
When you first started the group, how many of you were involved? You said that by the time of the strike, there were maybe 35 or 40. But in the beginning, how many of you were there in the group?
Well, it was rather a strange thing. We had people who would come in for a while and then sort of drop out because it wasn't a big thing. You know, it wasn't like, it was so serious. It was a very small series. And here you had people who had no other form of entertainment or anything. What were they going to do on Saturday nights to come up and just study and talk seriously? And now, a little later on, when we got about, 15 or 20 members, we used to try to have a Saturday night social. At least they could come up and play cards. And once in a while, we'd have a little, somebody come in with instruments, and we'd have a dance. It was a rare occasion. When we had the social affairs, yes. Mm-hmm. But that was very rare, and that was a damn deadly serious group, you know.
Now, was Kermit very involved in the group and committed?
Oh, yes, as long as I was, he was going to go wherever I did. Yes, he was. It wasn't his nature. It just wasn't his nature. He was not a bookworm, and he was not one who would sit down and read a political treatise or anything else, and he would love to get in debates and discussions, and then he was one who would take your ideas in the discussion. And the next time you'd hear them in a speech, you know, or something like that. But he was not the student that his father was. His father was the student.
And he was working in the automobile plant at the time.
Both he and his father in Plant 4, yeah.
Oh, so they were working here for many, many years before the strike.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Now, when you say working there for many, many years,
three or four years.
They would be laid off, and maybe they'd be laid off for half a month, a half a year at a time, and called back, and, yeah.
How were you living during this period? In terms of, economically, how were you managing to survive?
Managing to survive? Yeah.
Were you still getting help from your family?
No, I wouldn't take it. During the strike, Mother sent up baked goods and, mm-hmm. you know, pans of macaroni and cheese and the things that would last the children, and she would see that they had fruit or vegetables or whatever.
Now, do you know when? Then you in through this period, as you were becoming, your main activity was involved in the formation of the group and active in the group, and you had your one son. Then...
Am I on?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. No. I was going to get a cup of coffee for you and me both while we were talking, but I forgot.
Would you want me to add to it?
No. If this is on, is it on?
Then, is when you first developed tuberculosis. It must have been about 1933, because by the time your second son was born.
No. This son was born in the county hospital. I think the little one was about 18, or the older one was about 18 months or 2 years old.
Mm-hmm. So about 32 is when you first developed tuberculosis.
I developed it before then.
But I mean when it was first found.
Yeah, when it was discovered and I was in the hospital.
How was it finally diagnosed? Was you getting sick?
I was terribly, terribly weak. And I couldn't do my house, clean my house. I couldn't lift the baby sometimes. This was kind of a fat little roly-poly baby. And I couldn't do his diapers. I couldn't do dishes. I was dragging around and lying on the bed all the time. And my mother came up and said, Janora, this is a terrible habit for you to get into. I didn't like housework to begin with, but she thought that, you know. And my mother-in-law was climbing right up a wall. And that's, and she tried to persuade my husband then to leave me. She said, you've just got a lazy... I was a malingerer. And my mother would come up and she would talk to me and lecture me and she would help me. And I didn't know what it was. And I was going to a doctor. Mother said, you go to a doctor and find out what this is all about. And at first he was giving me something for anemia. And then he was doctoring, giving me some other medicine for my nerves. And then he told me I had a tipped uterus. And these things were dragging me down. Now imagine, in all this time I had tuberculosis and nobody knew it. And the mother, his mother, Kermit's mother, really put on quite a bit of pressure and got him to go over to her house, to leave me, and to go over. And on top of that, we were buying a radio and on time and something else. And she told him that if we were splitting up, that he should have that radio and this other thing we bought. What was it? And so he would have been very embarrassed to come up and tell me that. And so he went across the street from my mother, from his apartment place where we were living in my mother's building, and called me from a store or something there. And mother called me upstairs. We didn't have a phone. We were too poor. I went downstairs to my mother, to answer the phone, and he ran up and took the phone. And that's when I thought, what a weak person that he could let his mother talk him into something like this.
Was he giving you money, though, for you and your son to live on during the period he left?
Well, he didn't leave for very long, because the moment that I got him on the phone at home, I'd say, what's the matter with you anyway? You've got a little son, and I don't feel well. And he was convinced that I was a malinger. And it became a very sad thing because I couldn't convince anybody. And my mother was beginning to have doubts. When she began to have doubts, I began to have doubts about myself. And I would get up and just try to force myself and drag myself around. And it was a bad period there for a while until one time, and Kermit would come back and he'd go over to see his mother, and his mother would raise Cain again. Now, the father was against the mother's interference all this time, but this is a strong-willed woman. Okay. And it was because of her in the first place that I got all this. It's a crazy story. So he came back, and one time we were, after we'd eaten, we were having a cup of coffee, and I started to cough. And I'd had a little cough, and imagine with this little baby around, too. And I just started coughing up blood. And I must have coughed up a cup of blood, and I thought, well, this is unheard of. Only with diphtheria or a very raw, condition somewhere, which call, I didn't think about TB. So instead, I had for an interim period worked for a pediatrician. This was just an interim period where I went in as his office nurse. And I called a pediatrician and I said, Dr. Stevenson, I just coughed up about a cup of blood. What in the heck has gone wrong? And he said, where in the hell are you? I said, I'm over at my mother's. And then he asked me the name of my doctor, Dr. Kurtz. And he said, I'll be right over. And he came over and went over my chest. I said, if it's diphtheria, I said, surely he would have diagnosed it, this other doctor. He went over my chest and he sent me up to the hospital. And by this time, I had a cavity as big as a nickel and another one as big as a quarter or 50-cent piece or something like that. This is quite advanced development. You've had it for some time when it can eat that kind of a cavity into your lung. And so then I was kept in the hospital under these horrible county conditions, and my lung was collapsed, etc.
Now, and during the time your mother took care of son?
Yeah.
Now, tuberculosis in those days was viewed as a social disease. What kind of reaction was there of your family and of the people in that neighborhood that you lived to your having developed tuberculosis?
Well, it was like leprosy. Nobody wanted to be around you. And in fact, they called it galloping consumption then. And you were looked upon as an object of pity, that it wouldn't be long you'd be among the living. And I had lost, in the family, I had lost an uncle and an aunt on my father's side with tuberculosis. And it was just assumed it ran in the family, and poor me, I was it. So and my relatives were very apprehensive. I didn't have very much company up there. My mother would come, and my father, on the excuse that he hated hospitals, didn't come. And Kermit would come, and my father-in-law would come to see me. But that's all I had. I had no friends or anything else that was going to, stick their necks out. And it's understandable. Mm-hmm. They felt that they would contaminate their whole families.
At this point, most of your friends were people from the social study group?
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And really, I sort of felt, too, that they might be jeopardizing their families. But, and really, they would have been, because at the hospitals then, here I was with a collapsed lung and with people who were dying, which meant that they were contaminating. While I was had a collapsed lung and trying to build up my health, I was in an environment that was filled with TB germs, you know. There was no sterilization or separation according to degrees or anything. Later on, when I went into the sanatoria in University of Michigan, then they did divide us that way. But in the beginning, they thought you just had it and too bad for you. And many of them that went into the county hospitals went under experimental programs that cost them their lives. And I almost got caught that way, too, with the very beginnings of a pneumothorax, a homemade pneumothorax unit.
Now, the only place that you could be treated, or because of your economic circumstances, was the county hospital?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. You couldn't possibly afford hospitalization with a long-term illness like tuberculosis.
And your first hospitalization, then, was for about 3 months. And then for the next several years, on up through the trial, you were in and out of hospitals and cemeteries.
Three others after that. Well, two others, yeah. Then I was sent, I came home, and I was fairly well for a while, I don't know how long, and then I collapsed and was sent to Ingham County Sanatorium near Lansing. And I think that was for about 3 months. I could not stand these places any longer than that. Incarceration or somebody's seatbelt will drive me crazy. I can't stand to be restricted. And I became very apprehensive that I became depressed. And I just couldn't take it. I became very depressed. And so I knew I had to get out of there or jump out a window or something. Then I went, at the time that I became pregnant again, in this interim, let's see, what was it? My husband was going to take me out west for tuberculosis. And he and his brother got a very old car. It used to be some kind of a limousine or something. And they built a bed in the back of it. This is when I came out of Ingham County Sanatorium, and I couldn't stand being in there. And Ingham County thought that it was dangerous for me to leave, and they didn't want me to leave. That was it. So he was going to take me out west because people went out west where the air was pure and good and high in the mountains and so on. We went out to Denver, Colorado, and I think we stayed out there for 2 or 3 months until there was just no work. They shoveled coal off from coal cars and did everything. I pawned rings, everything to stay out there, but there's just no way.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the state of Colorado, I think, had to pay for our transportation back to Michigan because there's just no way. There was no welfare, no nothing. And so I lived out there in Denver for 2 or 3 months. And then by that time, when I came back, I was pregnant again. And my
still at this point, you knew nothing about birth control?
Nothing. No, I just, I didn't even know about the rhythm method, you know? Mm-hmm. These things weren't talked about.
You didn't even talk about it with other women in your social group, for instance?
No. I think I would have shocked them because they thought I was so far ahead in all my political ideas. Anyway, and racial ideas, everything else. And it was just not the custom. That was a private matter. Mm-hmm. It would be the same as you're going out and discussing today your the size and shape of your bowel movement to somebody. It's just a very private thing, and it was something that you took care of, and not took care of, but it's something that was part of your private life, and you just didn't talk about it with anybody. I can't tell you, it was a closed circle. This business of discussing was not even considered. Okay, and then before the birth of my younger son, the doctors in Flint thought that it would be too risky to keep me in Flint, even at the county hospital then, and they sent me to Ann Arbor University of Michigan Hospital, and there again 3 months. And it seemed, and here at the University of Michigan, it was a much, and in Lansing, I did a great deal of reading when I was there. That's the only way that I could keep sane. And in the University of Michigan, I was put in a ward with 4 beds, and I developed the ability to concentrate and read and study with all kinds of noise and racket and laughing and joking and things like that going on. And I studied and I tried so hard to stay until they said I could be released. And there was an Austrian doctor there. I had so many difficulties. I developed fluid in my chest all of the time, and they had to give you what they called the fluorescent pieces. And by this time, after you've had needles stuck in your chest for 5.5 years, or it wasn't 5.5 then, but 3 or 4 years, your skin becomes what they call elephant hide, you know, something elephant hide is, or elephant, it's like an elephant skin. When they stick the needle and they have you lying out like this, they have to use all of their force. And if you so much as twitch a muscle, it pulls it over and it hits the periosteum of the rib where your nerves are. And you nearly hit the ceiling when that happens. So sometimes it's very difficult. By this time, I began to be kind of a difficult case. And after every pneumothorax, I developed a fluid and on my lung. And it had, you know, in the chest cavity. And it had to be withdrawn because that can become, you know, infectious and so on. And so the head of this department was a Dr. Froelich, and he was an Austrian from Vienna, and he was a very incommunicative man. He would come in and look at you like you were a piece of machinery with his interns at the side, and ask questions looking right at you, and you couldn't talk to him, even if you asked, you know, a question. He would answer perfunctorily, and off he would go. He was a miserable creep, and this doctor, as the head of the department, wanted to take me in on the thoracentesis the third or fourth time and see what was happening. Now, the thoracentesis had developed in the pocket, and he had to go in several times to try to hit that pocket and under fluoroscopy. And by this time, I was wondering if I could keep conscious. You just feel like you're going to faint away. Sweat pours from you, and you just get very weak. And I realized I had to talk to this dumbbell if I was going to keep my own consciousness. And so I started talking to him and asking, what did he think about the baseball scores? It was during the World Series. I couldn't be less interested. That conversation was gone. What do you think about the new models of cars? What do you talk to a man about, you know? What do you think about the new models of cars that are coming out on the market? Really, I'm not in the market. I couldn't be less interested. And one after another, I couldn't find any way to communicate with this guy. And finally, I said, I understand you're from Vienna, Austria. And he said, that's right. And I said, well, did you ever know anything about the Karl Marx apartment buildings that were shelled by the Nazis when they came into Austria? And he said, how did you know about that? And I said, I've read about it. And I said, I'm a socialist. And he was, too. I was crying out loud. That was the craziest thing. After the fluid was drawn off and I was put back into bed, and the next time he came around, this man had softened up, and everything was very concerned about me, you know. And, of course, the girls in the room said, what happened to the room when you were out, you know? At the end of this, coming near the end of 3 months, I began to get in this terrible, terrible panic again. And I talked to him, and I said, Dr. Froelich, you know I can't stay in these places only so long. I'm going to jump right out that window. I can't take it. And, of course, the doctors had already made the decision, you'd stay. There's no other decision. And he had a long talk with me. And he said, psychologically, some people can't. It would be worse to, you know, keep you here. He released me. But there's another aspect. They used to give you orange juice and cod liver oil. And you had to take this miserable damn glass, in a water glass yet, with the orange juice floating on top. Every night, and I took it, and I couldn't keep it down. It was too rich. And I tried this 2 or 3 times, and I thought, what the heck? And there was no giving in on that. All of us in the room had to take it. There's no question about it. So I told him, all right, then, I've got to get my stomach completely calm, leave it on the table. The lights are all out, and I'm calm. I'll drink it then, but I can't hold it down otherwise. So there was a little sink in the room. Every night, though, I wasn't supposed to get out of bed. Every night, down the sink, you know, and they'd find the empty glass. And at the end of the month, my x-ray showed improvement. And did I get a lecture on, you see, you followed our advice, now the improvement.
you know, in a situation like that, when you were in the hospital, when you were doing all the reading, did you talk to the other, I presume that at this point when you were in the ward with four of you, the other three were women.
Mm-hmm.
Did you talk to them about your ideas, even without being explicit that you were a socialist? Did you talk
I told everybody. I was a very open person about it. I'm a socialist. So if there's any kind of discussion about Republicans or Democrats, well, really, I'm not very concerned because I'm a socialist. I did this, but I had no response from these three other women in the room, none whatsoever, and yet they liked me personally for some crazy reason. And they just loved it when I put my book down and talked to them for a while. But no, they would not, they couldn't. They weren't interested. There was no way I could reach them, and I tried.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't workers. I don't even remember what they were, but wherever they came from, it was like another world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Flint, in the county hospital, I tried talking to everybody, and there was a young man there, just out of the Navy, so goddamn patriotic, and he had a crush on me for some reason or other, this young man. So he used to come in. We could have no association, but he was able to walk around, and I was in my bed. He used to come in at visiting hours if I didn't have somebody or he didn't have somebody, and I would give him such a lacing over about his ideas and his politics and his Navy and everything else, and he became quite intrigued. And I did this up until the time I was discharged. And then I lost track of him, and I once heard he was a justice of peace out in the Clio, which is a little town there. This guy has retired from Chevrolet, and when I went back to Detroit, I got in touch with him again. And he is now one of the best militants in the Chevrolet local. I mean, he's retired, but before that period. And he's got some little farm up north, and every Christmas I get a Christmas card damning the damn capitalist system, and bing, 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 bing. So I guess maybe something stuck with him, although I lost track of him in the whole intervening years.
So during all of this, what I'm trying to do is basically establish what was happening and what your life was like during this period up to the real organization, like before the strike. You were involved in the socialist group, you were involved in this growing group, and you were in and out of the hospital.
Yeah.
As well,
right.
So that you had your health problem, your mother was taking care of your children while this was going on.
Yes.
So your life was
very
complicated.
It was. Very complicated. And as I say, I was the one who had to make most of the decisions for the family, hold the family together, because Kermit was just not that type of a guy. He was much more of a hedonist type. He would rather go out and have a good time and forget things for the night. You know, he was much different than I was, much different than his father.
Now, as you were forming your group there in the Pangala building, what was your association like with the people of all the other groups that were in the building? What was the relationship among the groups like?
Well, let's see now. The craft unions, we knew them, except the top bureaucrats. They were really the pork choppers with the big bellies. They were the real labor representatives. I can't describe them at that time. And they actually looked upon their own members as being lesser than they were. They laid down the directives, and they'd let the carpenters, the plumbers, all of them, these big labor bureaucrats, that they were the craft union men, you know, on top were queer creatures to me. But we would once in a while, the carpenters had a few good people, but mainly they were pretty conservative. They were the cream of the laboring crop in any city, in Flint included. And they, the majority of them didn't want to see the mass production workers organized, because they felt that that would be a threat to their craft unions, and that, you know, they might insist upon them being brought over with all these uneducated, untrained workers. But there were some good ones, and we had conversations with them on and off. Now, another thing, at that point, too, sometimes with these other workers, if you wanted to talk and recruit to them, you had to go to beer gardens, because this is where they congregated. And it was a big beer-drinking town, and we used to go to beer gardens quite frequently. Now, Dad could drink one or two or three bottles of beer, but that was his limit, and it was usually my limit, too. Kermit used to like to drink a little bit more. But can you imagine, and beer gardens always drove me nutty because they had jukeboxes in them, and they had lots of smoke, and everybody was talking, and most of it was nonsense going around. You know, they get too many beers. And here you are, trying to discuss socialist ideas, very serious ideas, and later organizing union and all kinds of things that were going on in the community. You know, with your heads together over a table, very close like this, and talking out loud so that we could communicate in these places. So there was a beer garden right down in the Penn Gallery building on the first floor, right on the street. And sometimes we would be able to talk to them upstairs. Some of the carpenters didn't want to come into the socialist hall. You know, it was like going into another country. That was a General Motors town, you know, the journal and the churches and everybody. Socialism and communism and anarchism were all very, very frightening words. So they didn't want to come into the socialist hall, but they knew us and we'd been around and so on. We'd go down and we'd talk to them about issues and things that were going on. Now, they had an AFL-CIO Trades Labor Council, and my father-in-law was part of that, and Kermit also. That was part of the little AFL-CIO craft auto workers, the carpenters, and all of the rest of them, you know, that were in the building. And there was very small attendance at all these meetings. And we used to go up there, and very little business was conducted. Very little organizational ideas, or how did you get this big giant organized? Because most of the AFL-CIO men didn't want it organized on a mass labor scale, you know, an industrial union.
So there was
a little socialist labor party group, a handful, maybe a half a dozen of them, and they tried to rent a room for a while. I don't think it was too long. They did have a little room up there for a while, but they couldn't keep up the rental on it. And then you had the Socialist Party and you had the Proletarian Party, who also had a room. And the Proletarian Party were educators, and they loved to study Marxism. And they had an educator by the name of John Davis, who was an artist also, and he used to give very, very good lectures on Marxism. Mm-hmm. Taking him right straight to...
Did your group would attend their lectures?
Yes, when he had a series, we would go over sometimes for a series, yes, and we got that. Then, a couple years before the strike broke out, they had a workers' education program in Flint, and I think it's sponsored by the Board of Education, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check back on that. And Roy Luther came in. I guess the... No, as an educator, and the workers' education program is the teacher. And he taught classes in parliamentary procedure and in workers' history, workers' education. And, of course, his being a socialist at the time, he interjected, made it an intensely interesting program. I don't know, I don't imagine his superiors always knew the way he was presenting this history, but it was very, very educational.
But it was from he was coming in from the CIO to do the work.
No,
education?
No, he was hired under the Board of Education of Flint. There was some special program. I'll have to go back into that. And it would have been like a WPA program.
Oh, I see.
I don't think it was WPA. It couldn't have been. No, it wasn't. They didn't have those classes until later. But it would be something like that type of thing. For education of workers, you know. And I still don't remember. I wish Roy was alive on that. I don't remember why those classes were set up. But those also were held in the Penn Gallery building.
And they would rent their own space. They wouldn't use the space of any of the other groups.
No. They had their own little room up there. I think it had workers' education on the door, too. And when we're talking about these rooms, we're talking about... Well, our first socialist party room, well, it would be a little longer than this, but a very small one. And then we got one of the other rooms that was a little larger. We had a piano somebody gave us.
So as you grew, you graduated into larger and larger sizes.
Yeah, the socialist party did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What were you doing, was the socialist party doing anything in terms of organizing the unemployed at that time? That's when the CP was involved in the unemployed councils and all of that. Were you involved in that kind of organizing at all?
No, I don't think so. If there was anything going on, it would have been up in the north end of Flint, because the CP then they met at Children Hall, and they were mainly the foreign-speaking element around Buick.
Mm.
And Buick never went on strike, and it was really never a part of the dynamic struggle that we had in the UAW. I don't think that hit down into the central area of the city at all.
Well, what would you...
Later on, you know, they had the Workers' Alliance. I think that period was the Red Trade Union period, wasn't it, prior to the strike?
The Trade Union League would be at that time period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what was going on more than their concentration on the unemployed in Flint. I think that was what they were trying to educate for, because whatever they were doing was so alien to the rest of the working people that I didn't have any contact with them, and I don't know of anybody in our group that did.
So your Socialist Party group was primarily the American-born workers in the shop.
Yeah.
And also from coming up from the South.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. It was, and so was the Proletarian Party.
Mm-hmm.
It was primarily more representative of the majority. The foreign-speaking group up in Flint was a very small minority, a very small part of the city population. It wasn't like Detroit, you know, that had big sections of Polish and Hungarian and so on. We had Russians and some Polish and a few Hungarians, but so few.
Mm-hmm.
So very few.
The difference was primarily the American-born. Almost all worked in the auto farm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.